welcome to Air in Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 30th of March 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that I have my co-host here with me, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon to you. How are you doing?
It's great, actually. Despite the loneliness of lockdown, we've got good weather, so that if anybody can get out into the garden, they can enjoy themselves. And life is very kind of peaceful and strangely remote. And it's difficult to imagine that we're going to keep this up for several months more. But there we are. We'll just have to wait and see. It's a little bit like being in house arrest. It's a little bit like being in suspended animation. It's probably a unique experience that none of our forebears had to endure, apart from perhaps those that lived through the Black Plague or whatever and remained in their houses with the doors locked so that they weren't contaminated by anybody else.
Yeah, it is like house arrest. That's how I've been looking at it. And they've actually been saying that, it could go on for 2 years. But I think that's a rather pessimistic view. It is weird not to have cars going past and not to have trains going past and airplanes flying overhead. Very strange, very, very eerie. But it really doesn't really affect us podcasters. We're used to just doing the podcasting and socializing over the internet. So we are really well placed to keep people going through this, I think. And I still haven't actually come across anybody that I know personally that's actually got the coronavirus. We've had some more famous people in Britain that have contracted it. Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister. Prince Charles, he's got it. The Health Secretary, he's got it as well. And this is quite alarming because, you know, it's Boris Johnson and the Health Secretary that have been saying, well, you've just got to stay 2 meters away from people and then you won't catch it. And yet they've caught it. And obviously they've been trying to stay 2 meters apart from one another. And it came out over the weekend that in actual fact, that distancing needs to be 4 times that. It actually needs to be 8 meters apart because of the distance that a cough or a sneeze can travel. But if you're wearing a mask, it's not going to be able to get out, is it? This is the amazing thing. They're still not telling people to wear masks. Obviously, what you really need is the FFP3. You need the FFP3 mask, which actually filters out virus particles. But just to be wearing any kind of mask over your mouth is going to be protecting other people from if you've got the virus and if you start coughing or sneezing or even just if you are talking. And it just amazes me that the government are still not telling people to wear masks, and the reasoning for that is just because they want to keep them all for the NHS, basically. It's shocking. But yeah, I don't know if there are any other celebrities that have actually caught it. Are you aware of any more in Britain apart from those three I mentioned there, Max?
Nobody of any great note. But going back to the thing about masks, making a face mask isn't really that difficult. And I haven't made one yet, but I've been looking into it and looking at like patterns on the internet. And I do actually have a little sewing machine. It's a strange thing for a man of my age to have, but I bought a sewing machine about 10 years ago, as it happens, that I was going to use for some particular project that I was on where I needed to sew something special that I couldn't buy elsewhere. And I kept this machine and I've never actually used it. So it's still in the box, still absolutely brand new. And it just occurred to me the other day that I might pop it out the box and get myself some white linen and just have a go and see how difficult it would actually be to make a mask. It doesn't look particularly difficult, and I would imagine they can be made quite cheaply. And it occurred to me that something that an organisation like the Women's Institute might like to do, where they've got lots of lady members who are going to be very skilled at all sorts of needlecraft, etc. If they just got a whole load of those people together and got them to make face masks, and then once they've made face masks, make a couple of them up for each person, and then just pop two in an envelope and mail it to a neighbor and or you know, mail it to somebody else rather more distant than that, so that eventually over a period of time everybody in the nation's got two face masks, one that they can wear and one that they've got in the wash, basically, so that you, each day you can put the new clean one on and put the other one in the wash. And that way I think that would be, you know, a very good thing for the nation to do.
Yeah, very sensible idea. It's like, you know, when this happened, I thought, well, why doesn't the government just hand out hand sanitizer? You know, the chemical that is actually in the non-alcoholic hand sanitizer is very cheap. It's very, very, very potent. And for peanuts, basically, it would have cost them nothing, really, to purchase a large amount of it and just send out liters of hand sanitizer to every house. And they could have sent out these masks as well, and that would have been a great help, instead of allowing all the masks and all the hand sanitizer to disappear from the shelves, causing people to be selling these things on eBay at incredible prices. I mean, I've seen masks going for sale on eBay for 50 quid, these FFP3 masks, and they were about £3 before this happened. We've had all these sort of problems with price gouging. But one of the main things that happened last week is they actually brought this new act in, these new powers for the government, which, as I say, they actually last for 2 years, and they can switch them on and off as they actually need them. And they said, well, we need this because people aren't taking the government advice. People are still going out. And incidentally, the mosques, half the mosques appear to still be open. Muslims still appear to be going out and meeting on tennis courts and all getting together to have their prayers. Nobody seems to be doing anything about that. But they brought in this new act to give the police powers to fine people and, if necessary, to actually arrest people. And it seems that they've been particularly overzealous about this, the police have, and they're really sort of rubbing people up the wrong way. This report comes from the Daily Mail. Police up and down the country are exercising their new powers to enforce the coronavirus lockdown, stopping people having picnics, dog walkers in the Peak District by chasing people with drones carrying loudspeakers. Officers have already issued fines to people breaching coronavirus lockdown rules less than 24 hours after the new laws were brought into force, the National Police Chiefs Council has said. But forces today are facing accusations of being overzealous as they use the sweeping new powers to crack down on people flouting the rules, using roadblocks, drones and helicopters to enforce the new laws. A council is facing a furious backlash after targeting members of the public with drones, as lawyers warned that police are unlawfully trying to restrict people travelling to isolated spots to exercise and walk their dogs, as the guidelines issued by the Cabinet Office do not prohibit driving somewhere for exercise or dog walking. Derbyshire police are now embroiled in a heated row after tweeting menacing drone footage, chasing and shaming ramblers and dog walkers in the Peak District. Neathport Talbot Council has also begun using drones equipped with loudspeakers to shout at groups of people outside, though some targeted claim they had been waiting hours for prescriptions before they were ordered to go home, and while queuing outside for hours waiting for groceries and medication. Critics say the unprecedented powers handed to officers by ministers will see the country sliding into a dystopia. And the Derbyshire police as well, over the weekend, they decided to fill a local beauty spot, a local lagoon, with black dye to make it look like oil or tar, just to uglify the place, basically. There's been uproar about that. And the police are saying, well, our excuse for this is that we don't want people on the roads because they might then have a car accident and then they might have to go to hospital and then it will take up the doctor's time, which doesn't really seem like a valid excuse to me. They just seem to be going way over the top with this. And it really, I mean, we have slipped into a police state and nobody's said anything about it. You know, we've been saying for years, oh, there's this creep, there's the Patriot Act in America, and after 9/11, the Snoopers Charter, the Conservative Snoopers Charter. Yeah, all of this. And we've been saying, you know, we can't allow this to happen. And just overnight, it's all happened, all over this scare of the virus. What do you make of that, Max?
Well, I think that if it's true that that mosques are still holding services and still open for prayers on Fridays and things, then I think that it's highly unlikely that we'll see any police officers going down there with their drones to frighten the the believers. And so I think that and all of the people that I've seen so far that have been chased and that have been shamed, etc., by the police, all appear on television, all appear to have been white people. So I think this is going to be another sort of example of the police choosing their victim with care so that they don't disturb racial sensibilities, I think. And because they know that white people are less likely to complain of racial discrimination. But I think that that there's a quite a high likelihood that that white people will be discriminated against by the police in terms of the enforcement of these things. You know, chasing somebody who's wandering on their own with their dog in the Peak District is just completely over the top, in my view. If people were going out on a ramble together, if it was all members of one family and they'd driven somewhere, got out in a car park and then just walked off down a country lane or something, then they're not really putting anybody else in danger, in my view. And for it to attract police action when the police don't normally even attend your house if you're being robbed or something of that sort, you know, it's just a virtue signalling on the part of the police, rather than them enforcing the law without fear or favour.
They seem to really not care anymore about community relations with the white community. I mean, the reason why people are going out is because if you live in these towns and these cities, you've got a local park where you can exercise, and that is filled with people. So the logical thing to do is, well, we don't want to be among all these people because we're going to end up being too close to them. We could end up catching the virus. I know, let's go to that secluded beauty spot that we know of where there's nobody likely to be. And we can go and walk the dogs there. I think, and that's what people are thinking. They're going out trying to do the sensible thing. And the police are flying drones overhead with loudspeakers telling them that they've got to go, they've got to get back. They've also been putting up roadblocks, and they've actually been bragging about this. I mean, this is what we know about it, because the police have put it up on Twitter. They thought this was a very clever thing to do, to chase people with drones. And I agree with you, Max. They're not going to go after the Muslims in this way. We've already seen that in France. The police have said, well, we just can't stop the migrants from going out in the migrant communities. And I did actually hear that 25% of the deaths so far in Britain were actually Muslim. I can't confirm that. That's just something that I read. It wasn't from an official source. That's just something that's going around. Maybe it's gossip. Maybe it's a rumor. I don't know where exactly that came from, but that seems to be what people are saying. So they're particularly picking on white people. And yet I think, and I'm probably correct in this, that the 75,000 volunteers that have volunteered for the NHS, I would make a guess that at least 99% of those are white. Katie Hopkins has been calling for the diversity and inclusion head of the NHS to actually provide the figures and tell us what the ethnic breakdown is of these 75,000 volunteers. Because you just know that it's going to be white people. What have we seen the non-whites do? Well, we've seen them put the prices up in their shops. We've seen them put up the prices of toilet roll. We've seen them put up the prices of hand sanitizer. And what have we seen white people do? Well, we've seen white people go out and help their elderly neighbors, give things away for free. And I think we've seen white people volunteer for the NHS. They actually asked for, I think, 25,000, and they filled that up straight away. So then they asked for more, and they actually got 75,000 people. And that's incredible. 75,000 yeah. People.
When they were showing the applause that people made for to show their our gratitude to the NHS, when that was being showed on TV, there didn't appear to be any ethnic minority neighbourhoods featured in that. All of the, you know, there were some people from ethnic minorities who were applauding, but they were individual members of ethnic minorities who lived in within predominantly white areas, and so it would be interesting to know whether the cameramen and the outside broadcast teams for the various media companies, whether they're actually discriminating against the ethnic minority communities by not featuring them enough.
good point there. And actually, that Daily Clap that they're doing every, I don't know if they're doing it every day or if they just did it on Thursday or Friday at 8 p.m. As they were doing that, I was thinking, well, I'm sure the NHS, rather than being clapped, I think they would rather have actually had the correct personal protective equipment that they needed, because 25% of the NHS are now down ill, either with the virus or with a cold that they think might be the virus, because the government didn't actually give them the equipment they needed to protect themselves. So to make up for that, we've got people clapping them at 8 o'clock in the evening, which to me, I mean, that's no compensation, just having people clapping. If you've got the virus, you would want your protective equipment far more than applause from people. And
I think the applause did actually have a good impact. And I think not necessarily just for the people that work within the NHS who were the recipients of that applause, but I think from the point of view of neighbourhoods, because when it was announced on television that this was going to happen the other evening, my wife and I had a conversation, and I said that it's something I thought that we should do, and she thought that we might look a bit silly if we both went out there and clapped and we were the only people in the street that did it. But I just said, well, I'm going to go out there anyway and just see what happens. And we both actually went out there, and virtually everybody had come out of the house and were all clapping in the street. So it was quite a good demonstration of solidarity amongst within our local neighbourhood.
And was that all white people that you saw out there clapping?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Mm.
There you go. Well, and also and this is interesting about this as well. The actual lady that arranged the applause for the NHS, she was actually foreign. She is white, but she was Dutch. And she was arranging this round of applause for our NHS. And, you know, I think this is the problem. The NHS seems to be for everybody. Anybody that sets foot in this country, they can use our NHS. And because of that, we don't have enough beds. We don't have enough intensive care units. We don't have enough doctors. We're being told that the NHS is completely under stress all the time, especially in the winters. And it's because of immigration, and it's because everybody's using it. And it just, you know, it just sort of really, I don't know, it brought it home to me when it was actually somebody foreign that was saying, well, let's all arrange this big clap for our NHS. I mean, they have done amazingly well to build this new hospital. It's actually in a conference centre, and they've got 4,000 beds in this pop-up hospital. They've also got a morgue there, and the doctors and nurses are going to be staying there on site as well. And I think there's going to be one doctor or one nurse for each 6 beds, which are going to be linked up with ventilators. So they are getting ready for this, and this is in London. And if this works out, they're going to have one in Cardiff, one in Birmingham, and I think one in Manchester as well.
That's right.
They've done amazingly well to sort that out. But you think, you know, 25% of the NHS are now off ill with the virus because they weren't given the protective gear. I've got the protective gear. I bought the protective gear back in January. Why didn't the government?
It's more that the testing wasn't there, because I think a lot of people within the NHS, because it's the winter time, well, it's springtime now, but, you know, we've just been through the winter. Lots of people get colds. Lots of people get the flu. That would just be quite normal. And you would just, you know, perhaps have a day off or two if you had the flu. But generally speaking, if you got a bit of a snuffle through a cold, you'd probably still go to work. And this probably would have happened within the NHS, but because people have had been showing some of the symptoms, which are both, you know, joint symptoms of both the coronavirus and the common cold, stroke, flu, those people have been advised to stay off work. And so I think some of them probably would ordinarily have just shrugged it off and gone to work anyway, had there not been the coronavirus, had it been the flu or something like that. And so therefore the number of people that are off doesn't really reflect the number of people who've got the virus. It's just the people who have been forced to take 2 weeks off just in case they might have the virus, just because they've exhibited some cold symptoms. And it would have made far more sense for us to have the the testing kits available. And again, this brings us back to the point where, as far as the protective masks are concerned, the protective gowns are concerned, and the test equipment is concerned, we have, because we've been pursuing a policy of cheapness and of sourcing all the things we use as a nation from the cheapest source, rather than sourcing them from the most reliable source and the one that provides employment for our people, we've been buying all these things from foreign countries. And that there's been a shortage of paracetamol, and that's because the component parts of paracetamol are made in China. And when the virus broke out in China, they decided they weren't going to export these component parts. They were going to make their own paracetamol with their own chemicals. And India, which is the world's largest producer of paracetamol, because they make it really, really cheap, because salaries and pay rates are very low in India, they suddenly had all of their supplies of the raw materials dry up. So they weren't then able to make the paracetamol that they would then normally sell to other countries around the world. And so other countries around the world, i.e. The UK, we've had a shortage of paracetamol as a result of this. And it's ridiculous that something that can be made very easily, something which is a drug that's been used for decades, that we just don't produce it in this country, and that we're happier to have our people unemployed rather than for the government to just build a paracetamol factory somewhere and employ a couple of thousand people to make paracetamol, so that if something like this happens again, we're not dependent upon supplies from abroad. You know, we need to have far more nationalism within the economics of this country, so that it makes us more secure.
Well, this is really highlighting all the problems with globalism, all the problems with it. I mean, I don't think we're actually making our own masks yet. France has just ordered a load of masks from China, and half of them aren't fit for purpose. They're supposed to be FFP3, and they said, well, they're sort of FFP 0.8, and that's not going to protect these doctors from the viruses. And I mean, we could be getting them from Russia. Russia actually make these masks, but I suspect that because of the sanctions on Russia, we've decided we're not actually going to get them from there. So all these things that are absolutely vital right now, our government has not prepared for it. It hasn't got any in stock. And
why aren't these masks made here in the UK?
Yeah. Why haven't they said that?
Maybe they might cost a little bit more, but at least we'd have a secure supply.
Well, hopefully they're going to do something about this now, because what they've done is they've requisitioned all the ones that were for sale for the public. They've taken all of those. So now the public can't protect themselves, which is the reason why they haven't been telling people to wear masks, because they don't want the public to think, well, hang on a minute, why are there no more masks on sale for us? It's absolutely scandalous that this has been going on since December. We first heard about this in December, and everybody was saying, close the borders with China. And they still haven't closed the borders. Priti Patel, of all people, said we ought to close the borders. We need to close the borders. She asked Boris Johnson just last week, can we please close the borders? And Boris Johnson said, no, we've got to still allow these planes to come in and out. So, and now Europeans, and British in particular, British are being attacked in India for being the ones spreading the disease, because Europe is now the center of this disease, and it's putting the lives of white people that are in these foreign countries at risk, because it's no longer the Chinese that are being seen as spreading this. It's white people that are being seen as spreading it because of the stupidity of our governments. And the head of the WHO, Dr. Ted, I forget what his second name is. He never advised the governments to close the borders at the time. And then a couple of weeks back, he said, oh, we've been asking for much stricter measures, and the governments just didn't listen to us. I mean, just absolute hypocrisy and being caught on the hoof all the way around, basically, and putting people's lives at risk. Interestingly, it seems that the people whose lives are most at risk are the Jews. Is the coronavirus an anti-Semitic virus, I am wondering? Jewish leaders have urged their community to preserve life after it emerged 1 in 20 of those killed by coronavirus in Britain are from the religion. The Board of Deputies has collated figures from Jewish funerals to record 25 coronavirus victims from a total of 465 in Britain as of Wednesday. This proportion of 5.4% could be higher, because not all the dead would have had traditional funerals, and Jews make up only 0.5% of the UK population, so that's 10 times as many Jews are dying of coronavirus than their proportion of the population. But Jonathan Boyd, Executive Director of the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, said it was important to be cautious when considering the data on Jewish deaths. He told the Mail Online, the numbers of COVID-19-related deaths among Jews does appear to be high at this stage, but we need to be extremely cautious about drawing any conclusions. It's not entirely clear how the figures were generated and whether the methods being used are consistent with national numbers. Statistically, the numbers are also very small, so the confidence intervals around them are large. It is possible that this is affecting Jews disproportionately than others at this stage, but it's really too early to tell. They could be skewed simply because someone who is Jewish happened to be infected early on, and to inadvertently spread the contagion before the lockdown within what is quite a close-knit community. One should also bear in mind that 2/3 of British Jews live in London. That might also explain somewhat elevated counts, as London generally is somewhere ahead of the rest of the country in terms of numbers of cases. And I thought this was particularly funny, because we're always being told about how anti-Semitism is virulent. Well, here we really do have some virulent anti-Semitism that's killing off these Jews. And also, you know, the Jews have actually got an exemption in this new act that they've brought in. The act says that when people die of this coronavirus, they have to be cremated, and they have to be cremated straight away. And the Jews and the Muslims said, oh no, well, our religion says that we can't be cremated. So they've got exemptions for that. So instead of the bodies being burnt up straight away with the least risk to everybody else, because the Jews and the Muslims are a special case, they're allowed to keep hold of their bodies. So once again, Christians are not going to be allowed to go to the funerals. They're not going to be able to do the grieving. But the Jews and the Muslims, they're a special case. Because of their religious exemption, they're going to be able to bury their people the same as normal.
We really this is an example class. Of what I was saying earlier on, of there being racial discrimination against the majority population as a result of the provisions being introduced, just simply because the police and the authorities are just terrified of being seen to be racist. And so whenever there's any kind of stringent restriction that's introduced, then there will be exceptions made, and in terms of the enforcement of those stringent restrictions, my guess is that they're going to tend to be less severe when it comes to ethnic minority groups. My own personal view with regard to these statistics of Jews catching the coronavirus is almost certainly that the numbers involved are just a too small a sample for them to be representative. I would imagine that it is just a statistical anomaly that once there are, and let's not hope there are too many more, but we're led to believe there are going to be lots more victims of this virus, and I would suggest that as the numbers grow, that the proportion of the people that are both diagnosed with the virus and also die from the virus will, amongst the Jewish community, will diminish to become a small proportion representative of their numbers within society.
There's probably one Jew that got this, and he brought it home to his family, and because they're quite close-knit, they live amongst their own community, that's probably why it's got a load of them all at one time, and they're probably all from one particular area. I do have a bit of good news concerning the non-whites in the country, particularly the refugees. There was a call by these various NGOs to say, well, we must let all these refugees out of the holding centres, because if they get coronavirus in there, they will all get it and it's going to be very dangerous. But of course, well, if you let them out, there's still going to be just as much of a risk. You're still going to have to house them somewhere if you let them out. And then most of them probably don't even speak English. They're not going to obey the laws. That's what they're not going to do, as they're told, quarantine themselves. This is what we've learned from what's happened on the continent. And thankfully, when it was actually brought before the judge, he said, well, no, we can't do that. We've got to leave them in these holding centres. It is a concern of what will happen to prisoners, from what we've seen elsewhere, like in Iran, they have ended up having to let the prisoners out, basically, so that they don't all catch coronavirus. I think that's something that we will possibly see happening in the future. Some of the less violent prisoners being let out. But the thing is, to actually be sent to prison now, unless it's for a speech crime, then it has to be a particularly violent thing that people have been found guilty of. And they need to have been found guilty of it dozens of times before they're actually even put in prison. So you've got some pretty nasty folks in our jails at the moment, and they could end up being freed under the guise of this. I think we're in level two at the moment. There's four levels to this. And I think in level four, it's when the army take charge and the police stop investigating burglaries. Well, they seem to have done that anyway, but the police stop investigating most crimes and the army get out there on the streets to actually help them. I don't know if we'll actually get that far in this. The army are helping to deliver masks. They're helping to deliver PPE to the NHS at the moment, but we just have to keep covering it, I guess. You know, as I said at the beginning here, at least we have, you know, we have these podcasts that we make. We have our online community. We can talk to our listeners. Our listeners can listen to us. We've still got this the social contact there that a lot of people are going to be missing. That don't have that part of their lives that they can do online, which I am grateful for. And obviously we will keep covering this as the weeks go on. Is there anything else you want to add there, Max, on the coronavirus in Britain or anything else on that sort of subject before we move on to Cecil Rhodes?
Only really, I suppose, the contrast between the way that the virus is being handled here in the UK and the way that it's being handled in the US, which I think that there's quite a stark contrast there where it's fairly evident because also not just the United States, but also Brazil, because Bolsonaro and Trump have both decided to proceed along a course of keeping their country's economies running whilst at the same time trying to isolate the hotspots. And in recognition of the fact that we don't want the cure to be worse than the actual virus. And as some people have said to me, oh, well, you know, don't worry about the economy because, you know, by doing what we're doing, we're going to be saving people's lives. But if we don't worry about the economy as well, then we'll come out of this, the virus will run its course. And then we'll find in perhaps 2 years' time that because we are so poverty stricken as a nation, because we're in an extended recession that's been caused by all the money that's been spent keeping everybody at home, that we may then not be able to afford the medicines and the all of the various health services that are required in order to keep lots of other people alive that are suffering from other things other than COVID-19. You know, and we hear in the news of people that have had cancer operations booked where those cancer operations have been deferred indefinitely. I think it would be a great shame if large numbers of people whose lives could have been saved end up dying of cancer or some other similar disease like that, just simply because there was too great a concentration on preventing the spread of COVID-19.
Well, we might have a bit of a reference point for that as well. In Sweden, they haven't locked down the country. They're still allowing gatherings up to 50 people. They've still got the restaurants open. They've told people to try and stay apart if they can. But they're basically keeping the economy going there. And I also saw some commentary last week from a medical expert, and he was actually saying the same things you were last Monday, Max, when you were saying about how what they should have done is basically quarantined everybody over 70, and then everybody who is younger could have continued to go out to work. The only thing different was that you were suggesting that people were actually polled as well to say whether they wanted to be quarantined or wanted to work. But he was suggesting that's what they should have done, is separate the population into two groups, those at risk or those most at risk and those least at risk, and allowed those least at risk to keep the economy going. So maybe we'll see that happening in Sweden, because, you know, it is a threat what it's going to do to the economy, and it's already becoming a threat to people that need these other operations and need these other things doing in the hospitals, because they're just being told, we're just going to have to wait. We've got to get over this corona crisis. And to think all of this could have been avoided, all of it, if they had just closed the borders. They just closed the borders to China. None of this would have happened. And why didn't they do that? Because they were scared of being called racist if they did. Shocking.
Yeah.
Well, let's move into Cecil Rhodes then, our final appraisal of Cecil Rhodes. Last week we talked about the naming of Rhodesia after him. We spoke about the Cape to Cairo Railway, which was a dream of his, which eventually got finished after he had passed away. We talked about how highly he thought of the British Empire and how he wished that it was the British Empire that was ruling the world, because the British race were the best suited race to do such a thing. We also talked about his views about race and how he saw the African blacks as a childlike race that needed guidance and that were better off with a more developed race in running the administration for them, which we said was borne out by what happened in Rhodesia once it became Zimbabwe with Robert Mugabe running it. And finally, we talked a little bit about how he didn't have a wife, and we were suggesting that it just wouldn't have been sensible for him to have a wife traveling with him in South Africa. Either he wouldn't have been able to do the things that he did, or this woman would have been at risk of being kidnapped, held hostage, and also all sorts of other things. And now we get to the Second Boer War. During the Second Boer War, Rhodes went to Kimberley at the onset of the siege in a calculated move to raise the political stakes on the government to dedicate resources to the defence of the city. So I'm guessing he went there so that the government had to concentrate on it, because this important man was actually in this city. His company was instrumental in the defence of the city, providing water, refrigeration facilities, constructing fortifications, manufacturing an armoured train, shells, and a one-off gun named Long Cecil for them. So this shows us how tightly interconnected these private companies were with the British Empire and with the government, I guess. Because, I mean, this is something that you would imagine that the army would be doing, but no, it was Cecil Rhodes' private company that went there and did all of this to protect Kimberley. Now, I don't know if it was the Second Boer War where they had the concentration camps, or whether it was the First Boer War. That's not something that Britain can be proud of. Do you know much about the Second Boer War or the Boer Wars, Max?
Boer Wars, I don't know a tremendous amount about, I have to say, apart from the fact that the Boers were perceived by the British Army and the British administrators of South Africa as being a very potent enemy. And there was a lot of talk in London in the very early 1900s of how it was disgraceful that an empire as big as ours was actually struggling to contain an uprising by such a small band of people who had so little behind them in terms of resources, and that it was recognised that the Boers, because of their knowledge of the African terrain, etc., were superior fighters in that kind of a situation, because they were able effectively to fight a guerrilla war. I don't know that there had ever been previous to this a guerrilla war fought on the same kind of scale, but the Boers invented the applied the guerrilla tactics and were very successful in doing that. And this is part of the reason why the British authorities out there were so severe in terms of clamping down on the Boers, and this is why we ended up with the concentration camps. I think where it comes to concentration camps, everywhere that concentration camps have been used, they've always ended up with there being massive outbreaks of dysentery and other
cholera
disease. Pardon?
Cholera. That's another.
Cholera. That's right. Your dysentery, cholera, and all that sort of thing, and resulted in large numbers of deaths of people. At the end of the American Civil War, there was a concentration camp set up in the South by the Union forces, and there may have been more than one concentration camp. But the point is that the soldiers from the South who were contained in these concentration camps Very, very large numbers of them died as a result of starvation and as a result of disease. And they emerged looking like skeletons, very similar to the sort of pictures that we see of people coming out of concentration camps in Nazi Germany. Then if we then jump to the Boer War, where the British created concentration camps that we put the Boers in, disease and malnutrition swept through those concentration camps, and the people that emerged, other than those that died in very large numbers, the people that emerged again looked like skeletons as they were coming out, because dysentery and cholera and those kind of diseases, they cause people to pass any food that they eat just go straight through their body in kind of like liquid form, and they have terrible diarrhea. And so that they don't actually absorb the nutrients from the food that they actually eat, which is why they then become so emaciated. Jumping forward again to Nazi Germany, it's very well known that the large numbers of deaths that occurred in the concentration camps were towards the end of the war, when the infrastructure within Germany that supplied the concentration camps with food and medicines, etc., where that was bombed to pieces by the Allied bombers, and so that the again disease, dysentery and cholera, etc., swept through the concentration camps, and again large numbers of people emerged in a very sort of skeletal form. Then switch to Bosnia. Again, there was a concentration camp there where the same sort of thing happened, and it's common feature. So I think that the use of concentration camps is a pernicious thing that should always be avoided in any situation. If there are large numbers of people that need to be contained, then the first thing that has to be on the minds of those people that are going to keep the prisoners there, if they're going to stay there for any length of time, has to be disease prevention, so that the sort of horrors that we've seen in those previous concentration camps aren't repeated again.
Interestingly, in the Second World War, I mean, one of the big problems was typhus, and the way that they dealt with that was actually the Zyklon B, the cyanide that they were then later accused of using to gas Jews with. But in actual fact, it was for getting rid of these mites that actually caused typhus. So that was one way of dealing with the problems of disease that we had in these camps. So the Boers were guerrillas, basically, and they didn't have a regular army. So, and this is why they were treated in such a harsh way. I guess that's what you're saying there, Max. And also, yeah, they were sort of pushed out of the area that they were in, weren't they? By the British Empire and by these big companies, they were gradually expanding all the time. And these Boers were being, they would settle a place, and then it would be discovered that there were diamonds there or there was gold there. And then, of course, the De Beers and the British Empire would want it, and the British Empire won.
Most of the Boers were religious refugees. They had left Holland because of the fact that they were being persecuted for religious reasons there, and then they travelled and found somewhere to settle in South Africa, and so they didn't have a government that would support them. They weren't supported by any external governments. There were the Boer people, who were primarily farmers, and they'd settled quite large parts of South Africa at the same time that the British authorities were going there and were developing farms as well, but also developing the mining industries and all that sort of thing that Cecil Rhodes was instrumental in setting up. But the sad thing is that the British government of the time didn't want there to develop separate nation states that were not under British control. And so it was a policy of bringing those areas under British control that caused the Boer Wars.
Yeah, it's a great shame. You know, they're quite noble men, actually, you think about it, pious Christian farmers trying to form a Christian nation over there. And it gets taken over by the British Empire, but there you go. Rhodes died of a heart attack at the age of 48 after being plagued by ill health all his life. The government arranged an epic journey by train from the Cape to Rhodesia, with the funeral train stopping at every station to allow mourners to pay their respects. It was reported that at Kimberley, practically the entire population marched in procession past the funeral car. He was finally laid to rest at World's View, a hilltop located approximately 35 kilometres south of Bulawayo, in what was then Rhodesia. Today, his gravesite is part of Matobu National Park, Zimbabwe. And, you know, I can imagine there must have been lots and lots of blacks that were there as well, marching along behind this funeral car. I mean, it wouldn't have been an apartheid thing. They would have seen him as a great man as well, for everything that he had done for South Africa, everything that he had done for Rhodesia. I mean, it's interesting to know that he had ill health all his life as well. And he wasn't well, wasn't a well man. And yet he, you know, he was a frontiersman and he achieved so much. And then to die at such an early age is really quite shocking. And I think there are attempts to try and get rid of his gravesite now because it's, you know, it's a very important place. It was sort of like a pilgrimage site. I mean, he's really sort of like the father of South Africa, isn't he? Cecil Rhodes, someone that, you know, people today still want to look up to. They still want to pay their respects to him, and yet he's accused of racism and being a white supremacist. And basically, he was just a good man, I think. And he wanted the benefits that his people had. He wanted to share them with other peoples, and he knew that they couldn't be shared with them on an equal footing. They could only be shared with them by setting a good example to them and gradually introducing these other peoples to what the technological advances that the British had, and educating them up to a standard where they could then manage their own countries, which is, you know, which is what they are doing today, is managing their own countries. And if
I think an illustration of the good that he did is that throughout the whole period of the foundation of South Africa and Zambia, Zimbabwe, etc., there was constant migration from the black countries of Central and Western Africa. There was constant migration from there to South Africa and to what was originally Rhodesia and then became Zambia and Zimbabwe. Migration of black people who wanted to find work and who wanted to improve themselves and earn money so that they could improve their lives. And so, you know, it's very similar to the situation that exists in Europe today, that an illustration of how good our society is and how, compared with elsewhere in the world, is that so many people want to come and live in our country. And I think that as far as Rhodesia and South Africa are concerned, that same principle applies, that very large numbers of Africans wanted to come and live in those countries so that they could enjoy the fruits of the civilization that Rhodes helped to create.
I think another point to make is when we look at these other places that were colonized, we look at Australia, we look at New Zealand, we look at America, none of those places, or Canada, none of those places have handed over the reins of power to the natives. But if you look at everywhere that the British Empire colonized, it was all handed over to the natives after the war. So which shows that, you know, we were educating them, we were civilizing them, we were trying to teach them how to maintain a government, how to maintain civilization. Some of them may not have done, you know, so well at it as well as we could have hoped. But it does show that the British Empire did have a positive side to it. And that was how it was seen by the British people. It was seen as a very positive influence on the world and on these native peoples. And the proof of the fact that it wasn't about turning them all into slaves or oppressing them in any way is the fact that these countries have been turned over to them. And none of these other countries were. You know, I think that's an important point. Whether you agree with the British Empire or not, you know, you can't argue against that. The people who were in those countries that had a British administration are now running the administration themselves, which is a credit to the British, really. And again, it bears out what Cecil Rhodes was saying about the British people being just, about them being the best people to be put in charge, because they were prepared to hand it over to these natives when the time came. Well, let's have a look at his will. At his death, he was considered one of the wealthiest men in the world. So consider that. You think of the wealthiest men in the world today. You think of the Rothschilds, think of these big bankers, and how many of them are patriots? How many of them are nationalists? Bill Gates, is he a nationalist? Is he proud of where he came from? Is he proud of his heritage? Is he doing his best for the country that he's come from? No, they're all globalists. And so this is the difference. Cecil Rhodes may have been a wealthy man. He may have been the head of De Beers and diamonds and all the rest of it. But he was a patriot. He understood that the reason why he was so good at what he did was because of his ancestors, because of the blood that flowed through his veins. In his first will, written in 1877, before he had accumulated his wealth, Rhodes wanted to create a secret society that would bring the whole world under British rule. And we've got a quote from that. "To and for the establishment, promotion and development of a secret society, the true aim and object whereof shall be for the extension of British rule throughout the world, the perfecting of a system of emigration from the United Kingdom, and of colonization by British subjects of all lands where the means of livelihood are attainable by energy, labour and enterprise, and especially the occupation by British settlers of the entire continent of Africa, the Holy Land, the Valley of the Euphrates, the islands of Cyprus and Candia, the whole of South America, the islands of the Pacific, not heretofore possessed by Great Britain, the whole of the Malay Archipelago, the seaboard of China and Japan, the ultimate recovery of the United States of America as an integral part of the British Empire, the inauguration of a system of colonial representation in the Imperial Parliament, which may tend to weld together the disjointed members of the Empire, and finally, the foundation of so great a power as to render wars impossible and promote the best interests of humanity." So this is the sort of supremacism he had. It was to promote the best interests of humanity and to prevent wars. And how is this to be attained? Well, by energy, labour and enterprise, by hard work, not through usury, not through bribing people, not through corruption, but through hard work. And this, obviously, this is a bit of a fantasy, a bit of a utopian ideal, but he was a young man when he wrote this.
And well, some people will point to the fact that he was trying to create a worldwide system under and to extend the British Empire into a worldwide system. They would say, well, this is just globalism under a different name. But the difference here is that the worldwide system that he envisaged was one in which the burgeoning population of Britain would be resettled in other parts of the world. And so therefore, the people who had made our empire great would go out to these other countries and make these other countries great as well. Whereas globalism today is completely the opposite. Globalism today is one where the peoples from the countries that have failed to develop their countries are growing in population and are coming to settle our countries. And so whereas the aims that Cecil Rhodes had were eugenic, the aims of world globalism today is dysgenic, i.e. it's increasing the numbers and increasing the sway and influence of those people who are least able to build civilization and to maintain a civilization, whereas Rhodes' dream was of one which would be disproportionately oriented in favour of those people who were able to create civilization and were able to advance science and art, etc.
That's a good point. And I mean, at this time, this is before contraception and abortion. And, you know, we understood that the nation is continually going to grow, and we only have a limited resources. We only have a limited territory. We are supposed to go out into the world and conquer it. We're supposed to go out there and take dominion. And the best people, the most industrious people, the most hardworking people will be the ones that dominate. And that will be best for the people that are in those countries, because their living standards will be raised up. The whole point of this was to improve the lives of everybody throughout the world by having the people of the best quality running the world, not diversity agendas where you elevate the people that are least qualified, but a proper system of merit in order to render wars impossible and promote the best interests of humanity, the total opposite of the New World Order that we have today. And there was talk of this secret society still going and influencing America before the first World War, and that this was why America was on the side of the British rather than on the side of Germany. But if we look back to what we were talking about last week, Max, I mean, he saw the Germans as friendly. He saw them as part of the Anglo-Saxons. He didn't see them as enemies at all. And Adolf Hitler was thought very highly of Cecil Rhodes. So maybe that should be looked at again, this idea that it was because of this secret society that America came down on the side of Britain against Germany, because Rhodes's idea was to have Germany as a part of it. And it was basically the Anglo-Saxon races all together ruling the world. Well, his final will, go on.
I think it's fairly clear that the foundations and the scholarships, etc., that Rhodes initiated were effectively hijacked after his death, in the same way, as I said, I think last week or the week before, the same way the Ford Foundation was hijacked by people who want to use the resources that are there for globalist purposes rather than for the purposes that Rhodes originally intended.
Yeah, it was all based on merit. Rhodes' final will left a large area of land on the slopes of Table Mountain to the South African nation. Part of this estate became the upper campus of the University of Cape Town. Another part became the Kirstenbosch National Botanical Garden, while much was spared from development and is now an important conservation area. So he was responsible for the University of Cape Town. So if it wasn't for him, there wouldn't have been this resource for South Africans to study. And of course, then we have the Rhodes Scholarship itself. In his last will and testament, he provided for the establishment of the Rhodes Scholarship, the world's first international study program. So he was a genuine philanthropist, genuinely wanting to do what was best for the world and get the brightest pupils and ensure that they were able to get the best education. The scholarship enabled students from territories under British rule or formerly under British rule and from Germany to study at Rhodes' alma mater, the University of Oxford. Rhodes' aims were to promote leadership marked by public spirit and good character, and to render war impossible by promoting friendship between the great powers. So that gives an example of it there. As part of his legacy, on his death, Rhodes left a significant amount of money to be used to finance talented young scholars, and race was not a criterion at Oxford. Currently in Oxford, a number of those South African and Zimbabwean recipients of funds from his legacy are campaigning for his statue to be removed from display in Oxford. When asked if there was any double standard or hypocrisy in being funded by the Rhodes Scholarship Fund and benefiting from the opportunity, whilst at the same time campaigning against the legacy of Rhodes, one of the South African campaigners, Nkosi Kwabe, replied that "This scholarship does not buy our silence. There is no hypocrisy in being a recipient of a Rhodes Scholarship and being publicly critical of Cecil Rhodes and his legacy. There is no clause that binds us to find the good in Rhodes' character, nor to sanitize the imperialist colonial agenda he propagated." Well, no, there's no clause in it, because just logically you wouldn't do something like that. You wouldn't bite the hand that feeds you. It's quite clear, race was not a criterion in this. It was all about merit. And if he hadn't done this, Nkosi Kwabe would not even be at Oxford. And there he is trying to pull the statue down.
And a lot of great men that we regard as being the thinkers of our time and of the sort of the modern era, a lot of them were in lockstep with Cecil Rhodes and what he was trying to do. I just happened to have picked off of my bookshelf as you've been talking a copy of H.G. Wells' Anticipations: The Reaction of Mechanical and Scientific Progress Upon Human Life and Thought, which was written around about the beginning of the last century. And he talks throughout this book to a great extent, where he talks about the New Republic, which will be effectively exactly the same thing that Rhodes was trying to create as a British empire spanning the globe. And he says the ethical system of these men of the New Republic, the ethical system which will dominate the world state, will be shaped primarily to favor the procreation of what is fine and efficient and beautiful in humanity. Beautiful and strong bodies, clear and powerful minds, and a growing body of knowledge, and to check the procreation of base and servile types of fear-driven and cowardly souls, of all that is mean and ugly and bestial in the souls, bodies, or habits of men. And so, you know, that is sort of fairly graphically there describes the thoughts that H.G. Wells had with regard to the sort of thing that Cecil Rhodes was trying to create.
Well, that's been completely reversed now, hasn't it? You know, I mean, yes. What they wanted there, they were leadership marked by public spirit and good character. Is it good character to campaign for the destruction of all statues of the person that gave you your university, the university of your capital city, and paid for you to go on a scholarship? I mean, that's not good character. We elevate bad characters now. We elevate people that don't have a public spirit, that just, you know, want to climb up the greasy pole and get to the top themselves. It's all become completely reversed. I mean, you can see the value that these men back then, that they placed in honor and loyalty and being honorable. And if we look back at Shackleton and how he honored his promise to come back and rescue his men. And, you know, you've got the same thing here. That sort of a character, that British, indomitable British spirit that we have, it was trying to inculcate that in young men so that they would grow up to be good, honourable men, good representatives of the empire, men that were going to set a good example, that people could rely upon to keep their word and to be honest and to just be good people. And that's what it was all about. It wasn't about trying to make as much money as you possibly can, and this capitalist idea of wherever you can make the money, you make the money. If there's a loss of some kind of a product, then you have to put the prices up and make your money off the back of other people's misery. You know, this idea just wasn't there. It was let's raise the living standards of everyone. Let's keep good moral laws, and let's make sure that the people that lead us are of the finest character, of the absolute finest character, with self-discipline, and are going to set a good example, because we've got these other peoples here, these less civilized peoples, and if we don't set them a good example, then everything's going to go to pot. I mean, that was a large part of it, was you know, helping out these other races, these less civilized races. And, you know, he really has done a lot to help them out. And if you look at South Africa, I mean, it was a first world country, and if the system had been kept in place that he was a part of, they would be far better off now than they are. I mean, they're actually asking for the white farmers to come back now, aren't they? Because they've realised the mistake.
They are. That's right. Just hopping back to the coronavirus that we were talking about earlier on, I've heard from people that I know in South Africa that the government there have imposed a lockdown, which makes the lockdown here appear quite mild, in that people have been told they've got to stay in their homes for the foreseeable future. They're not allowed out for any reason.
Shocking. I don't think they've actually had that many people with it. In Tanzania, they've had zero numbers of people with it, and they've gone into full quarantine as well. Or it might have actually been Malawi, not Tanzania. One of those places, they haven't actually had anyone with it. I just think that you know, the black race and the Negro race, they're just less susceptible to it. You know, we do have these differences, these biological differences, but yeah, we'll just have to see what happens over there with as far as the coronavirus goes. And also, I've been really pleased to actually learn all this about Cecil Rhodes, because I possibly had quite a negative view of him before we started doing this series, Max. I sort of saw him as being something to do with Rothschilds. I wasn't aware that the man was quite such a patriot a proud British patriot. So I've enjoyed covering that, and I hope you listeners have enjoyed that as well. Thank you very much for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Aerie in Britannia for you, and of course we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.